CEOs going into that, but your Uniden receiver, you know, I would make that a separate wire and just bring it out outside the window, maybe to a mag mount or, you know, some simple antenna. You don't need that much height or anything on a basic receiving antenna. You know, I would keep that separate, I think. Back to you, Brian.
I would like to put something on the roof, but I also have to deal with ground and lightning protection. 82 OGB.
Well, ground and lightning protection. The way that I handle it is I have a copper strap attached to the base that the antenna is mounted on, and it goes down to my backyard and goes wraps around a cold water pipe, which is easier for me than to run copper tubing because it's paved with cement. But if you have just grass or something, you could pound a copper plated rod into the ground and use that. There are different ways to do lightning protection. You could put little couplers that short out for lightning strikes. Other people just disconnect their coaxes from their shack when it's lightning and thunder. A lot of people don't do any of that and get away with things. It sort of depends whether you're the tallest place in the area and you're in an area that has a lot of lightning discharge. You know, in my area of Brooklyn, there's 100 different buildings much taller than mine. So although I belt and suspenders it, I'm never particularly terribly anxious about lightning strikes. And I don't know anyone in this neighborhood who actually had a lightning strike. I'm sure someone must have at some time.
On mobile, it's bound to happen, but like I said, I want to put something on the roof. It's just a matter of being able to do it correctly. I mean, I could go with Paul's idea and do something telescopic and then just somehow clamp it, and then I could, like, have it, like, near the peak of my window, so it's not like directly in front of me, but rather on the side. And I guess that's one way how I could maybe hook up an antenna. I feel like that I say that I do the research on these things and just never do it.
AC2GS. Well, that's true. You have to actually read through the stuff and think about it. I think I pondered the question of what kind of antenna for a good 3 years before I had anything particularly useful in my shack. So, you know, time is always on your side. Again, although I think Paul has a good suggestion, I think it would look cleaner if you just had an antenna sitting on your roof above your window, and the only thing that people could see on the side of your house was a relatively thin black coax cable that just went into your shack room. I think that would, again, because people don't really look up. They look forward, they look down, they seldom look up. So, and there's a lot of different ways to mount these things on roofs. Again, if you don't like to put any holes on anything, you can just have a very simple weight mount where, again, you screw it into these steel things, and they have a high surface area at the base, and you just put a couple of weights down like an expensive cinder blocks, and it leaves no holes. It's not going to leak. It's not going to upset your mother. And as long as she doesn't stare always at the sky, she's not even going to see it.
Here's what I'm going to do. First, I'm going to ask this question directly to Paul. You said that they make telescopic into. Tell me the name of it, and where can I find it?
I know Harbor Freight had one about, I guess, about 3 years ago. I'm sure they still sell them. And each section was like, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 feet long, and then, you know, it opened up that way. I know somebody who bought one. You know, people buy it and they put flags on top, you know, American flags. But there's nothing stopping you from putting a couple of clamps up there and attaching a diamond or a comet to it. You know, I mean, even me, I'm not attached to that at all. I have a pipe going straight up for my 2-meter antenna. But of course, in my case, I put a rotator on and I put a 2-meter, 10-element Cushcraft antenna that's vertically polarized, so I could point to Glen Oaks, or I could point to Selman. But you know, and then as far as the grounding is concerned, you know, if you want to attach a clamp on the bottom, now you're this thing. If you're going into the ground like mine, you know, that becomes my ground. You know, I could attach a clamp to that, and if you want to ground something off, or you do what Roy's talking about, you could just ground off your radio to the inside of the house to a clamp on a water pipe or on the inside of the house or the outside, like what Roy's doing. You know? But, you know, you need step one. You know, if you could get this... Bring up a telescope. It's about 2 inches in diameter, I think. Telescopic... pipe, you know, for harbor freight. I'm sure they sell them. It's easy, you know. You throw it in the trunk of your car and bring it home and set it up.
I'm going to go, as soon as I get to where I need to be, I'm going to put this all in my notes, and I'm going to try to do as much as I can when I get home, since I can sleep in tomorrow and I don't have to be work until late. I really need to put this all together before I actually start buying and actually doing everything. And I could think of it like this. I don't want to literally look at the antenna straight out my window. I could move it like to all the way to the left or the right where I can't really see past the window, past the parameters, and I can just put up an antenna right by the edge. And then literally just have the wire, like, almost visible right out of the corner of my eye. I mean, I'm thinking like that.
Okay, and by the way, when you Google it, just put in a, you know, flagpole antenna. Or, you know, go with that. I'm going to turn back over to you, Roy, AC2GSWS2N.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, there are so-called flagpole antennas. What they amount to is they're fiberglass hollow poles that camouflage a conductor like wire in the middle that then just kind of goes to the coax cable on the ground, and that's usually for homeowner associations where you can kind of sneak an antenna sitting in a flagpole. There's all kinds of material that you can use as elevating support. They make those out of fiberglass. They make them out of carbon fiber. And they make them out of aluminum and steel tubing and such. So there's all kinds of different tubing. If you have a backyard and you have something, some structure that's high, you could mount it to that. If not, you can secure a mast to either bang it into the ground or fasten it against a sturdy portion of a gate if you have a fence or something, and you can mount it on the top of a mast that way with the coax cable going down the ground and off to the side and into your shack. There's a lot of different things. I would try and urge that you get as much elevation with your UHF VHF antenna as you can, because you're going to have better functioning antenna. As far as HF, it sort of depends upon what kind of an HF antenna you decide on. If it's a vertical antenna, you can put it on the ground if you have proper number of radial wires shielding from ground loss. But when it comes to something like UHF and VHF, elevation is incredibly important.
Roy, I found it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a a 20-foot telescopic flagpole kit. That's what they call it. $64.99. So, I don't know. You can get fancy, put your antenna up, and then put a flag below it if you want. But, I often thought of this, but I have my own galvanized steel pipe going up, so I don't need this. But, you know, the first time I saw it, I said this would be great for an antenna. It comes with, it's 5EZ to assembly, rust-proof aluminum section, extends to 20 feet. Very cool. Yeah, how about that? They include the flag, the U.S. flag. Back to you, Roy.
KB2-HHU.
But there's a couple of verticals I was looking at that I think Diamond makes, and now that I think I could maybe make that work, because I don't know what he was looking to do, but my good buddy Ronald from Rocky Point, KD2TT, actually has a few flag mounts. I don't know if he uses them for HF specifically in his Jeep. I don't know exactly, but I do know he has a couple of flags that he actually waves around with his Jeep. It's kind of cool. So I think a flag pole would be a very suitable idea just for even VHF, UHF. I think I can make that work.
And I know you're creative, so you just have to figure a way to, whatever antenna you get, figure a way to clamp it to the top of this thing. That's all. Back to you.
Yeah, one thing you got to think of, let me see if I have the repeater. Okay, one of the things you have to think of is you really have to secure that pole, because if you're clamping the pole on one end of the pole on a windowsill or something, and then you have a long length, and then you have some particular weight of antenna, that's a lot of torque. You consider the amount of force along that axis, plus if it's a windy day, you need to have rather sturdy support for that pole. I think in Paul's case, he has it on the ground, which gives you a great deal of support. But if you're going to kind of clamp it in the middle of where your windowsill is, you really have to think hard of a very strong mechanical support that's not going to have it bending and whipping around in the breeze. By the way, Sigmund, KB2-HHU wanted to say something. Sigmund, what did you want to say?
Yes, how you doing, Roy? KB2-HHU. Just FYI, I actually have been using that flagpole antenna for Harbor Freight about 5 years now. Got it on the corner of the house, and I have it supporting a vertical 11-meter antenna and my off-center-fed dipole at the center, and I got the legs, you know, going out to the yard, et cetera. And basically concrete base, very simple to pour, you know, like almost like a fence post kind of insulation, and I have like a strap up basically where I have the topper, you know, upper part of the extension of the pole, you know, basically like strapped to the roof, the side of the roof, you know, through the flashing, et cetera. And that gives it a lot of support. 5 years, heavy winds, and it seems to work so far. Watch, tomorrow it's going to fall down, but so far so good. KB2-HHU.
Ah, very good. Yeah, I don't want to give you the evil eye there. Well, I mean, the trick is that you supported it at both ends, again, because you have to be aware of the torque forces on something like that. If you just secure it at the base, that might be enough, but it might not. It can still produce a great deal of stresses on it, and it might fail. But by supporting both the base and the top section, you lessen the torque considerably. So for Craig, if you're planning to use something like that, you really have to think of it in terms of what kind of torque forces it might manifest based upon how you're going to support it. You know, at one end isn't as good as two ends, and you need to have them supported in a relatively sturdy manner. You can't just kind of put a little electrical tape around it and just kind of stick it to something. So, you know, it's certainly doable, but you have to understand the forces at play.
All right, fair enough. I want to look at these flag poles and see what I can maybe come up with. Paul, can you send that to my email, KD2OGB at AOL?
Yeah, okay, great. Very good. KD2OGB at AOL?
More or less, KD2OGB at AOL.com, yes.
Will do. Very good. Back to you, Craig.
Okay, so that's one leg. Do you want to touch upon the HF at all, or you want to save that for another week?
I'll pass.
Okay, well, thank you for participating, and I wish you good luck. And, again, make sure everything's secure because, you know, I'm sure your parents aren't going to like if it kind of twists and turns in the wind. So, you know, really lock it down as best you can. So I wish you luck, Craig.
I really should have done this when I first got my tech license, and immediately my parents were just like, oh, you can't do this or that or whatever. This is my house, whatever. And I'm like, come on. I have my extra now. Just let me do this already. Like, I will even show you and have someone professional, like one of you guys, like show how it should be done, considering that you think it's just not going to work out. But I will eventually make it work out and prove them wrong. So I do thank you very much for the help, Roy, as I'm getting closer to where I got to be. So time for me to say AC2GS Net Control, KD2OGB Mobile.
Okay. Again, wish you all the luck. I'm sure you can convince your parents. If it makes you feel any better, I knew an amateur radio operator who at the age of, I believe, 62, couldn't convince his mother to let him put up an antenna near the house. So, you know, people much older than you have had this problem.
Yep. All right. Toodaloo, 82 OGB Mobile.
Okay, once again, this is AC2GS. We have another question awaiting, but it's not amateur radio related. So if there's someone out there who has an amateur radio related question and would like to ask it at this time, let me know.
Well, it is partially ham radio related.
Okay, then we'll go to you, Wes. What's your question or your comment for tonight?
It's a relation of dielectric to longitudinal electric field. Sounds weird, but I explain it. And the proton accelerator using medical field, which would be your specialty. But I'm going to start from the electric resonator and the antenna.
Okay, I think you touched upon that a couple of weeks ago, and it's primarily designed for microwave, low-power microwave devices. But please, feel free.
Yeah, so it's interesting that in that antenna radio wave is introducing to the inside of the resonator material, which is the dielectric from the transmitter circuit, and bounce back and forth between the resonator walls forming sending waves. So those walls are partially transparent to radio waves, allowing the radio power to radiate into the space. But it's not about the antenna, it's about the electric. The frequency for operation is 6 gigahertz, 7 gigahertz up, but talking about 5G moving up and up, I hope that FCC will leave us some room in 60 megahertz, gigahertz range if technology will become available. By the way, question to you, Roy. What is the highest frequency band used by ham radio operators?
Ah, that's a good question. Unfortunately, not one that I have readily available, because I know they do work in microwaves. I believe it can go as high as 75 to 81 gigahertz. Actually, it goes even higher than that. I think there's some experimental work that goes on in 241 to 250 gigahertz.
Okay, so then from the dielectric, I was switched to another dielectric equipment, which actually was quite interesting. It's a proton therapy. Okay, so we have a very inexpensive device comparing to a typical cyclotrons and synchrotrons used in therapy, and it's only $20 million. So it is like we have a tube that is negative just ahead of the proton and positive inside of the proton that is in it, because protons are positively charged, they accelerated toward negative and away from positive, so the power supply switches the polarity of the sections, pushing that synchronized bunch of protons up and up and up, like in typical waveguide. But not for particles. And, okay, we have a dielectric, so I was trying to find out what is that made of. So I found that this accelerator tube is made of, from sheets of fused silica that is only 215 micrometers thick. So after polishing, the sheets are coated with half of the micrometer of chromium, and that chromium is the base for 2.5 micrometers of gold. Now you have in one section about 8 layers of sheets just stuck together and then heated in a furnace where they fuse together. That stuck assembly is then machined into the hollow cylinder having a hole inside. So imagine that you have something like a sheet of sheet that is 2 feet by 2 feet having a hole inside. Fused silica is pure transparent quartz glass, a dielectric, which is why the machine is called dielectric wall accelerator. And then I was trying to understand how that proton is here, what actually makes that proton inside. And then I was looking, what do we have? We have a hydrogen atom, right? It has the one electron and one proton. So if we somehow take out the electron, then we have just the proton by itself. There is no neutron there.
Wesley?
Yes.
Hydrogen, by definition, is one proton, one electron. If you ionize any hydrogen gas, you have protons.
Yeah, I know. But it was my fault. So the hydrogen atom, yes, the electron is negatively charged and moves about the positively charged around the positively charged proton. And But then what is the conductor? How what kind of conductors can conduct the proton current, if we could name it. So I'm not a fan of the proton current, but if the ion is not flowing through the wires, it is only flowing within the battery chemistry. But then we're dealing with the fluid. But in the proton accelerator, we have no fluid.
Yes, Jeff recognized. I just want to make a comment. The way that device only costs you $20 million to build it, apparently, it's a traveling wave device. So it is the traveling electromagnetic wave which has at its rear a negative, a positive charge, and at its front a negative charge that pushes the proton forward in the direction of those kind of mini accelerators. But, Jeff, you want to say something?
Yeah, thanks, Roy. Just, I work tangentially with synchrotrons and storage rings and linear accelerators, but... you're throwing a lot of terms out there, Wes, and you haven't spoken about a specific machine. Is this a general question, or is this about one exact machine? There are very many of these things, some of which cover acres, some of which fit on a tabletop. Go ahead.
Actually, a few machines. One is the electric wall accelerator DWA for medical proton therapy. It has been developed by Compact Particle Acceleration Corporation. That would be one. But in the general terms, we have in Wikipedia the electric wall accelerator, which is the explanation of how it looks like, and describing all of those modules. The possible application is EBRT, which is the external beam radiotherapy using protons or ions. Does that ring the bell?
Yeah, all of it rings a bell, but you jumped right into the middle of it without really telling us what you were talking about. But that clarifies things. Back to that.
Thank you very much for your comment. I try to be more accurate in it. One more thing related to it is, just a moment. Okay. We have something like the blooming lane, which is the pulse-forming device. That is the core, because somehow we need to have a power connected to it, to the tube that is made this way. And I got into the very information about it, which says that it was actually proposed in 1903, no, 1942, I'm sorry. That was by the guy who was the Dover Blooming Lane. And he was working in sound television radar. And he built a very clever power supply that is used in that kind of accelerator. Okay, so shortly we will say that the electric wall accelerator is a class of induction accelerators, employs a some sort of novel insulating beam tube that impresses longitudinal electric field on a bunch of charged particles. And the question that I have to Dr. Roy is what kind of proton devices is used today in hospitals?
Well, Wesley, I'm not a radiation oncologist, so I kind of send people to radiation oncologists. There are all kinds of semi-destructive radiation equipment that is designed to preferably kill cells with a higher metabolic rate, usually cancerous. So there's a lot of radiotherapy out there that uses different isotopes and accelerators and what have you. Unfortunately, I can't be terribly specific because it's a specialty in and of itself. Matter of fact, we do have a club member who is a radiation oncologist. I've heard him on the TechNet in times long ago, but I haven't heard him lately.
That I've got is I went to U.S. Department of Energy Office of Scientific and Technical Information, and I found that the dielectric wall accelerator is a class of induction accelerator that employs a beam tube to impress a longitudinal electric field on the bond of charged particles. So if we go to theory in transverse wave, the oscillation of the field is perpendicular to the direction of propagation of the wave, and in longitudinal wave is parallel to the direction of propagation of wave, so electromagnetic wave is transversal, not longitudinal. But then I was interested why it has something that is called longitudinal electric field. And then I went to waves in plasmas, which actually says that waves in plasmas can be classified as an electromagnetic or electrostatic according to whether or not there is an oscillating magnetic field. And when we're applying the Faraday law of induction to the plane waves, I'm not going to go deep into it, it's the electrostatic wave must be purely longitudinal. An electromagnetic wave, in contrast, must be transverse component, but it says it is partially longitudinal. But then I thought, okay, in the proton accelerator, there is no plasma per se. We have a bunch of protons that are traveling. And I've got that gas behaves the same as the fluids. So the longitudinal electric field in working gas flows from one electrode to the other, but in this world, the plasma jet is generated by using longitudinal electric field that generates between two rods of electrodes. So, for the gentleman that is experienced with accelerators, I have a question: how that is being done physically? Interesting. I hear no answer.
Wes, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, Jeff is a chemist. His expertise is primarily, I believe, organometallic chemistry. He does have experience with other things, and I guess if he thinks he could answer your question and he wants to, then please, you know, Jeff, answer Wes's question, I guess.
Oh, my sincere apologies. I was called away from the radio, and I just got back when Dr. Roy was suggesting that I should answer the question, which I didn't hear. Sorry, Wes, go ahead.
I was comparing a longitudinal electric field in plasma, in fluids, and to the same behavior of the gases, and then how that is physically done, because it's something that appears for some that is against the known science, where the electromagnetic wave doesn't have longitudinal field. But actually, that's the part that I explain. So my question is, in accelerators, how that flow of the protons is being done, including that part of the longitudinal electric field that is present there.
I would love to answer your question, but I'm going to have to take a bit more physics. As Dr. Roy so aptly mentioned, I'm an organometallic chemist who studies biophysics now, and I can really answer any questions about that stuff you want.
Would you please continue?
I can continue about biophysics and chemistry. Anything else you're going to have to ask a, I don't know, I guess a particle physicist.
No, not necessarily particle physics. Physicists would know about proton accelerators because it's a specific machine with its own phenomena in use. I was, but you mentioned that you had been having an experience with synchrotrons and other types of accelerator centers.
Yeah, I worked out at Brookhaven National Lab and Argonne National Lab, and what I did was I took biological samples there and irradiated them with X-rays, which, as you know, come off tangential to the electron beam, which is ordinarily in a storage beam, and it's presumably being maintained in that path, down a linear path, and using magnets to turn it, the same way you're talking about the protons, certainly on different scales and different frequencies. But as Dr. Roy, already aptly stated, these are traveling waveguides, and you know, anything more you want to discuss about synchrotrons, particle accelerators, and storage rings is really going to have to be directed towards the physics group, and I can't answer that. So someone else on the net may be able to. But as I said, the X-rays that come off of those can be those rings can be highly electron storage rings can be highly collimated. Especially if you're using a wiggler or an undulator, where you end up with harmonics. The X-rays can be collimated, and they can be focused, and they can be passed through a monochromator for use in studying biological samples in a crystalline state, which is what I do, which is termed X-ray crystallography. Go ahead.
That is actually the field that I'm at, even though I'm more into particle physics. I have a few EDX machines here right now in my lap, and two electron microscopes. So, yeah, interesting is the collimation undulation process, but probably it's going to take too much time to explain all of it. Anyhow, I believe the major difference is that the proton accelerator is not using magnets, it's using actually very much synchronized impulse and to exist.
Very good. Back to net.
Okay, that's interesting. Let me drop for a second and make sure I have the repeater. Okay, once again, I'm AC2GS, Roy. Yeah, it's a shame, John, WA2SHO, used to IRLP from Los Alamos, and occasionally he would talk about how they use RF in accelerators. The problem that I always have, Wesley, when you bring up longitudinal electromagnetic waves. Well, you'll notice they don't call them longitudinal electromagnetic waves. They call them longitudinal electrical waves, which is a curious, interesting way of describing them. I think it's more of a longitudinal directed electrical charge manifestation. It's a traveling wave that's going down the pointer vector, as opposed to waveguides that have these pseudo-longitudinal magnetic electrical field characteristics. So almost every time when someone mentions longitudinal with electromagnetism, there's usually some qualifiers, some quotation marks, some sticking the word like into it someplace. So I don't think that you could discern this as the true electromagnetic wave in free space. These are all special cases where the medium is not free space and where the conditions are a little bit flaky and the use of English is a little looser.
Yes, you feel coming.
Yes, please, feel free.
Thanks, Roy. I just wanted to mention that there's another guy who sometimes joins some of the other nets. He's a participant in the Brookhaven net, and actually he's the net control in the Brookhaven net, KD2TRG, I believe is his call sign, Bob. And he has built a lot of the equipment out of Brookhaven, so, you know, if Wes is really interested, he could contact KD2TRG and ask him some of these questions. This is a guy who's in the physics department, actually building the equipment, and understands, you know, linear accelerators and particle injection. He understands synchrotrons. He understands storage rings, and could probably add a lot to the conversation. And perhaps one day he'll join us here and really let us have it.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
Yeah, he's a very smart guy. I agree with Jeff. You can actually even talk to him. He has, I'm not quite sure if it's a TechNet or a RagChu, on Tuesday nights. I think it's 8 o'clock. It might be 9. He's available on EchoLink. The repeater is the lab has a ham club, and it has a repeater, and they do a rag chew on Tuesday night, so you could check in on their Echo Link and ask them these questions, and I'm sure he'd address them.
Thank you very much for the information. I'll see if I can contact with you. I wasn't talking about electromagnetic wave, longitudinal electromagnetic wave. I was talking about longitudinal electric field. So the dielectric wall accelerator, it's an accelerator. It deploys a beam tube to impress the longitudinal electric field on the bunch of charged particles. So if I remember correctly, the tube may permit the attainment the accelerating gradients of 100 megavolts per meter, and in that accelerator the whole core is the power supply, because there are no magnets here. It's just the power supply that is pushing a bunch of protons from one segment of the tube to the other, and I was explaining the same as before. I don't know if you've heard it. When I got into wave in plasmas, let me jump. Then it clearly states, and as the articles in Wikipedia, waves in plasmas, it clearly states that an electromagnetic wave is transverse, but might also be partially longitudinal, and that partial longitudinal is at certain special cases or situations. So I was rather interested, what are those very special cases that would be fluids and that would be gases. By that I was interested in structure of that new form of the proton accelerator that is actually gases, it's not fluids. And thank you.
KG2RY.
Yes, David recognized. I just want to put in my two cents. I think we're getting really blue sky esoteric, and I don't think we have any practicing physicists sitting around waiting to chat with us. My little two cents worth is these devices seem to be based upon traveling wave type of transmission lines or antennas. They're not the usual standing wave devices that most hams are used to. Most of amateur radio antennas are standing wave based phenomena. That's the whole reason why you want to resonate them is because of the nature of it. But for the most part, as far as I'm aware, these things operate either as waveguides or transmission lines or traveling wave devices of one kind or another. That's the only thing I can offer. David, what did you want to say?
First, I want to say good evening to everyone. I hope you're having a fantastic night so far. You know, you're talking about this idea of magnetic field, and magnetic field is invisible. You can't see it. So I guess the idea is, you know, with all of this technology and physics, whatever, you know, that you want to make a picture of what a magnetic field looks like in certain circumstances and other circumstances. It made me think of a magnet and the, how to say, the shards of metal, you know, and the pattern that it made, you know, when the magnet was introduced to the shards of metal. Go ahead.
Let me stand it. No, I wasn't talking about magnetic field at all. I was talking about proton and ways of the protons to move, whether it is proton conductors or proton acceleration, whether it is in fluid or it is in a gas. So just a few minutes more, I'm going to finish. When I mentioned proton conductors, I was talking about electrons, well, owing to the emitting core electrons, well, protons can be ionically conducting, become ionically conducting materials. They are transported by environment vehicles that I could mention, phonons, and makes keep it strong acceleration effects of often extreme mobilities. And phonon, by that matter, is not photon, is how to say it, the collective excitation in periodic elastic arrangement of atoms on modules in condensed matter. So it's specifically noticed in solids and some liquids. But of course, we may say that in gas we have a similar mechanism taking place. So interesting thing that we can have a proton conductors, we can have the longitudinal electrical field, and we can have the acceleration taking place. But I hope that Dr. Roy has some news about how that typical proton, proton therapy looks like. Say a few words about it, don't you?
Okay, once again, I'm not a specialist. It's a little bit better, they say, than X-ray radiation treatment for cancers because the field is a little bit more focusable. So it's a more precise means of targeting tumors than, say, X-ray radiation. There's a whole group of different type of forms of cancer that are treated with local X-ray treatment and or local proton treatment. There's head and neck cancers, there's lung cancer, there's liver cancer. You know, just about anything that is visible and limited to a certain place and space and time, they'll blast it with protons if they can to destroy as much as they can. The problems tend to be a lot of these things metastasize to other organs. They're less accessible, and you have to actually be able to locate the tumor itself to expose it to either X-ray radiation or proton radiation. But that's the underlying idea of proton therapy. It's a high-energy, destructive beams that kill tumor cells.
G2RY?
Yes, David.
You know, I had a thought about this, you know. There is such a device, I think it's called a Geiger counter, where you can detect radiation, cancer-causing radiation, in your home, or in fruits and food, and you can buy these on eBay. I don't know how effective they are. And I guess the idea is, you know, if you have some kind of radiation under your floorboard, and it's causing such a problem, you know, could you basically remove, you know, you open the floor you take the material out from underneath the floor and put the floor back, and you lose at least some of the susceptibility to getting sick. Go ahead.
Well, actually, Wesley has more than a few radiometers, Geiger counters, and other devices. I don't think it's the problem tends to be kind of dirt. The problem is that radon is not unusual. People have been exposed to radon gas, which is a decay product usually in basements, and so it requires a great deal of renovation to clear the area of radon gas producing radioactive material in the earth. But radioactivity is all over the place. You can't live a radioactive free life, unfortunately, anywhere. Banana has a radioactive decay. You can detect it on a sensitive enough Geiger counter. Just taking a plane trip will increase your exposure to radiation because the air in the atmosphere blocks a lot of space radiation and such. So there's radiation all about us.
Yes, it's true. And when my sisters were looking for a home, you know, they're going to settle into a nice house, my mother did research to be sure that both of those houses would not be, you know, too close to any toxicity. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, there are some toxicities that we know about, and there are toxicities we don't know about. You don't really know about radon gas. Again, it's a decay product from stuff that might be very close to you near your basement, as opposed to these places where they do dumping of chemical and very dangerous materials. Then the runoff, you can kind of be suspicious of all that. But there's a lot of risk and danger in this world. And like I said before, we're all exposed to radiation. It's the amount of radiation that is an acceptable average number. You should try not to exceed that if at all possible. And if you do, then your risks of things like cancer increase. There are a lot of people who lived in Ukraine when the nuclear reactor went critical who got exposed to a lot of radioactive material and are still to this day suffering from increased risks of cancer. Recently, the Russians invaded Ukraine, and they were silly enough to set up right next to Chernobyl and probably killed a whole bunch of privates who were told to dig up radioactive soil surrounding the place for God knows what reason. So, radioactive. A lot of things are invisible. A lot of things that are bad for you are either invisible or so small that you cannot perceive them until they do their evil work. So, you know, it's a shame, but that's life as far as I'm aware.
And to extend.
Yes, Wesley.
Sure, it's about it. A few factors. First, what is radiation? What kind of radiation do you have? We have a alpha, beta, gamma, and X-ray radiation, and we have neutron. So, we talk about gamma, it's electromagnetic wave, and it's not a particle. And at the time, that could be actually supported with some Geiger counters and some other type of devices. But then we have, and of course, scintillators, which use a cheap plastic, and others use a germanium detector. Then we have alpha and beta. Those are particles. Beta, big and heavy, and very, very slow. They are really stopped by the the skin, so they are not harmful till you swallow it. Then it becomes a problem. One of the Russian dissidents was killed with polonium by Russians, typical to them. And that was in London. Beta, even though that is, I love beta. I love beta. I saw beta. I mean, you cannot see beta, but I saw beta. Let me tell you. Okay. Beta is extremely violent and extremely vibrant. It's beauty looking at it. So I have a device that is taller than me, so it's like 9 feet. Eight feet. 8 feet by four feet. And it is using trialetolamine. It's high electric potential to actually spot betas. Extremely sensitive one. And there is a whole program that is able to see and visualize it. And I connected additional monitor on my own that was able to see in real time. It's a beauty, but it can be stopped by paper. It's really not harmful. So the problem with radiation you may have is the time of exposure. So if you have a place like a Chernobyl, we're talking about the square root of the distance in the square law, and that applies there and for all of the radiation. So if you don't touch the soil that has all of the heavy radio tops there. Emitting any kind of radiation, then after so many years is not that much harmful, but you should not be there. In other words, if you have a cesium-137 and you have a very, very tiny amount that is used for probes that I have, and you put it under your pillow and you sleep on it 1 month, you may have a negative result. But other than that, you never have a problem with bananas. And to XGN, back to you.
AC2GS. Well, I just want to point out, because you didn't mention it, don't know, beta particles are just accelerated electrons. Minus beta particles are positrons, but that's what they are. They're just electrons. They're usually traveling relatively fast, but they're free electrons. Alpha particles are basically the nucleus of a helium atom. So you take a helium atom and you ionize it and rip the electrons off and throw it real fast, and it's basically an alpha particle. Now, one other little question, because I love this particular subject. What's the difference on the planet Earth between X-rays and gamma rays?
The difference is in wavelength. Gamma rays has much higher frequency intensity.
No, that's the astronomical explanation, because astronomically you can't tell where they came from. Historically, on the Earth, X-ray is emitted from a high-energy electron, and a gamma ray is emitted by radioactive decay. So since, in this world, in our labs, we know exactly the source of the high-energy electromagnetic waves, you can theoretically have an X-ray that's the same exact frequency as a gamma ray if the X-ray was produced by collision of a high-energy electron and the gamma ray was due to decay of some radioactive isotope.
Correction, and the correction is you said that beta particles are simply electrons. Well, we're not talking about electrons. We're talking about origin of the particles. So beta particles originate from the core, from the decay in radioisotope from the reaction of the